Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have back on the show Carl Hamers. Of course, Carl is the proprietor of Taboo Truth on his Substack. He also is a regular, well, what had been a contributor to the Occidental, right? Occidental Observer.
Yes, I have 30 essays there in the archive, but no longer submitting.
Yeah. And then also with, the Barnes Review, right? Several articles of the Barnes Review.
Just about every 2 months when
Yeah.
that magazine comes out, I have at least one essay.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, the Barnes Review. I see that. I get that on PDF. I read that, try to get a chance to read that whenever I get the when I get the time. So okay. Well, anything else you want to add or
I do have a
anything?
book published, Covert COVID Culprits.
That's right. We had
That's
an interview about that. That's right.
we've had at least four. Have we had
Yeah.
four interviews? Maybe this is the fourth.
That's right. So, well, tonight you have this discussion, the origin of the polarities plan or the polarities plan, this idea of declining and rising empires and how they're being manipulated by a globalist, a cabal, a secret group, if you will. And you wanted to discuss the, you know, the history of this and also how it applies to current affairs.
That's right. Yeah, I appreciate you bringing me on to discuss this. I think it explains a lot in history and it explains a lot that's happening today. I think if a conceptual framework allows new developments to fit into it without changing the framework, then it's a good one. And I find that's true with the Polarities Plan.
Now you're speaking like the multipolar world, the bipolar world, the unipolar world, and now we're being, it seems like the all the events, the wars, the various decisions, alleged mistakes, misgovernance, and all this is leading us back to a multipolar world, right? The BRICS, the rise of the BRICS, the decline of the American. The apparent decline of the Anglo-American Zio Empire, and this is following a certain a pattern in history: rise of the British Empire, the rise, decline of the British Empire, the rise of the American Empire, and the Cold War, and the end of the Cold War, the unipolar world, and then apparently we have the various, I guess, the American leadership, political leadership, making a series of missteps, maybe filled with. Hubris, as they say, this is a, you know, sort of a moral interpretation. They're full of themselves. They make the mistakes, and this just creates what's called the Thucydides trap, which you discuss. So this sort of this, the inevitable warfare between the declining empire and those powers or that power that seems to be ascendant. So I'll let you take it from there.
Right. Yeah, I have two essays comparing the Polarities Plan to the Thucydides Trap, which I first heard on your show, Powers and Principalities. And I thought, well, this is a good comparison. The Thucydides Trap, meaning as one power is declining in the world, another power is rising, and there's a tendency for them to engage in a war. The man who wrote the book, Allison, right?
Yeah, Graham
He
Allison.
studied, yeah, Graham Allison. He studied 16 different examples, and only 12 of them resulted in war. And we know that wars have been started for other reasons than rising and declining powers. So I felt it was a limited theory. But let me see here. The Polarities Plan, I summarize thus. The Polarities Plan views each of the major shifts in world power presented as polarity shifts, not as natural and organic movements of power generating wars among rivals to compete for dominance. Instead, it views the rise and fall and shifts of power throughout history with their concomitant wars as engineered by a largely hidden metapower. The agents of this hidden metapower operate in both nations. Apparently involved in the power struggle with a concern for neither. Their concern is only in using competing nations to shift power to their next political and, in some sense, religious dispensation, the next polarity shift. So we, you,
this should require a group to have sort of a rootless cosmopolitan outlook on things.
Yes, it would require them to be, to have power in many places throughout the world. And it's important to the Polarities plan to know that they have power within those two powers that seem to be competing, but not exclusively. They have a meta power above and beyond all that. And that could largely be considered to be the money power, which is international, certainly, and is very much involved in orchestrating or arranging these polarity shifts. And we can talk about that with the de-dollarization occurring right now.
But well, historically, though, give me a historical example of this.
Well, my timeline, I've actually pushed the timeline further back. But in my two essays, I started with the unipolar British Empire ending in 1945, the bipolar US-USSR world ending in 1990, the unipolar US world, which is scheduled to end in 2030, and then the multipolar BRICS plus world, perhaps ending in 2075. And the one thing about the Polarities plan is that it has an endpoint. It has a final goal. And I sometimes call that the Jew world order, one world government. That's located in Israel, and the timeline for that is forevermore. That's the plan. So it's good for a meta-analysis of history to have a final goal. And this one does. But to back up to it, a good example was how the unipolar British Empire shifted to the bipolar US-USSR Empire. Most people are told that the British Empire ended in 1945 with the end of World War II. And one way that happened, we talk about the money power, the Lend-Lease Act was passed in the United States during the war, and it was supplying some war materials to Great Britain. But overwhelmingly, it was supplying something like 90% to the Soviet Union. But that was downplayed in our media and government spokespeople, and the supply to Britain was played up. Now, Great Britain was charged the full amount of those lend-lease supplies plus interest. And there were literal gold shipments across the Atlantic. However, the Soviet Union was charged nothing at the time, and only a token percentage, pennies on the dollar afterward. So this was preferential treatment, and it reveals a deliberate plan by the money power to degrade the unipolar British power and raise the USSR and US power right into the bipolar world for the next 45 years. That's just one example of how the British Empire was shifted. What really, one of the things that got me thinking about the Polarities plan was reading the book by Nestor Webster, published in 1931, The Surrender of an Empire, in which she explains and chronicles the ways in which the territories and colonies of the British Empire were being given away. They were being handed out from within to their original nations. Some of them went communist. And that's really struck me. Ramsay MacDonald was the prime minister of the Labour Party. He was working internally to give away the colonies of the British Empire. As far back as 1917, the British recognized the Soviet Union after the Bolshevik Revolution. Igor Zinoviev, one of the main communist Jews who organized the revolution, was quickly in London spreading communist propaganda in Great Britain at a time when Great Britain and the Soviets had basically a propaganda pact. They both agreed to use only neutral or positive propaganda against each other. But Zinoviev was using negative, and Ramsay MacDonald knew it. So these are clues that the Polarities plan is in effect. The forces within both competing nations or empires and beyond them are working together to shift the power. I think that's one good example.
So you see the decline of the British Empire is not a sort of a result of two disastrous wars, but part of a plan. Those wars are just being part of that plan.
Yes, that's my view. And the wars were major factors.
Did this explain why the British royal family didn't accept the Romanovs as refugees, give them a safe haven from the Bolsheviks in 1918?
Well, I hadn't thought about that, but that's why this conceptual framework is so useful. We can fit that into it without changing the framework.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure other reasons were given.
Mm-hmm.
but
I mean, it's fairly well known that the Bolshevik Revolution was financed by the West.
Yes.
Not just Germany sending Lenin, in a sealed train, from Switzerland, but also the U.S. working with Britain to send in Trotsky. That, you can see how the Germans might want to send Lenin in to disrupt and take out Russia, which was an adversary, but it makes no sense for United States and Britain to do a similar thing in sending Bolsheviks to disrupt Russia, because they're part of the, I guess at that time, the Tsar's abdication, so a month before America enters the war, but Russia is part of the Triple Entente. So again, you'll see that there's sort of a meta level there, making decisions and doing things behind the scenes. It is another telling example is the, I believe the head of the German Central Bank at the time was a Warburg, and the head of the New York Fed at the time was a Warburg. Same, they were brothers or cousins or something. So that gives you a transnational nature of these, the transnational cosmopolitan and also ethnic, the importance of ethnic ties in these, mm-hmm. In these relationships that supersede or transcend national boundaries.
Yes. Yeah. Max and Paul Warburg,
mm-hmm.
Jacob Schiff sent $20 million at the time to these Jewish Bolshevik revolutionaries from the Kuhnlo Bank on Wall Street, Schiff being at least an agent of the Rothschilds, if not a family member married mm-hmm. in. Which is, on the shallow level that most people are educated or miseducated, the idea of like capitalist Wall Street funding communist Soviet Union is inexplicable. It's a tautology. But we know that the two powers are basically fused. The capitalists use the communists, and the communists use the capitalists for their common objectives. At that time being the shift of power from the British Empire unipolar world to the US USSR multipolar world. And then when you see the ongoing support, material support, basically the life support that the West, particularly the United States, supplied to the Soviet Union before World War II, during World War II with Lend-Lease, and afterward, right on up to 1990. It's astonishing. That was another fact I learned that led me to develop the Polarities Plan. Why in the world was the United States sending entire factories, huge sums of money, all kinds of tech transfers, expert personnel to help the Soviet Union develop into a further industrial nation? When we're supposed to be at war with the communists, the Cold War, it became a hot war in Korea, something of a proxy war for the Soviets, but we were still, lavishly supporting the Soviet Union. I feel like the Soviet Union couldn't have existed without U.S. support. I call it life support, thereby creating this dialectic, this, in a sense, this phony Cold War conflict.
Well, it's a managed conflict, and it's an idea when you create a global crisis, you create a sort of a governing principle of global crisis. It enables you to undermine, you know, local government, constitutional government, accountability, at the same time, get wealthy off the public debt, you know, the public credit, the government credit. And obviously with the creation of the petrodollar, in the 1970s, you know, after the collapse of Bretton Woods, you know, the skies were the limit, as we can see now with the U.S. debt now, what, $34 trillion? You know, and there's no sense in at all in Washington D.C. of cutting back at all or slowing that down. But I think it was Anthony Sutton, I mean, back in the 70s, who wrote about this in his research. I think he was kicked out of the Hoover Institute for exposing this. So he was stepping on a lot of feet by pointing out, you know, just by following the money, if you will, looking at the bank receipts, the canceled checks, and these things that our supposed adversaries were lavishly funded. But this is the business of war. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the smoking gun for some like overall plot for world control, because you can also cite similar arrangements during the World War II with Germany, and also with Standard Oil through multi-level or transnational companies. Good example, I think he found out that Standard Oil through subsidiaries were providing a key aviation fuel to the Luftwaffe during the war. Same thing with General Motors, their subsidiaries were providing, building vehicles and tanks for the German army. It isn't to say that the folks at General Motors or Ford or Standard Oil were sympathetic towards National Socialism. It was just business. And mm-hmm. God forbid, why should a global war stop business? But you say there's something more than that. It's not just money. This is a sort of a consolidation. There's a crisis, out of chaos, a new order. So you have, you know, multipolar before World War II, bipolar after World War II, unipolar. Now they're moving on to something else.
Multipolar BRICS Plus.
Mm-hmm.
I do have to say I have a different understanding of Anthony Sutton, at least his book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read it, but I've read some critiques and I've pondered what he has to say. And I think it's basically propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually quite wrong. I refer to Henry Ashby Turner's book, German Big Business and the Rise of Hitler,
mm-hmm.
which I think presents, it's in the mid 80s, presents the best documentation of the funding for the National Socialist Party and during its rise, and although not into the wartime.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we could look at dispensations, political dispensations now, and see if they fit into the Polarities plan, the war in Ukraine, Russia. There's a fair bit of evidence, which I find very fascinating, that Russia is not fighting to win the war. They appear to be even fighting to lose it, or at least not to lose it. You know, they seem to be fighting to prolong it. It's pretty clear that Russia could easily win. And I've been following some of the work on Slavland Chronicles, Rurik Skywalker. He was writing as Rolo Slavsky on Occidental Observer. There's a lot. He says right from the beginning of the special military operation, there was complaints from within the military strategy department and, former military men in Russia about how Putin was conducting the war. They weren't supplying the proper ammunition to the front. They were making poor strategic decisions, withdrawing from strategic areas they could easily occupy. They called them regroupings. And, you know, I started to think, well, if the Polarities plan is in effect to shift power away from the United States and into the BRICS Plus world, This is what they would do. They would prolong the war in the Ukraine, which BlackRock has plans to rebuild as the first model Great Reset nation. The ultra digitized, what did they say? Something like the most digital and convenient nation in the world. He uses the word convenient. Ukraine.
So it's, in order to build it, you have to destroy what's already there, yeah, and depopulate it.
Yes, right. There's
isn't that the original Khazaria or?
Well, something like that. Wasn't the area where Jews were given the why can't I recall the name of that?
The Pale.
Pale, the settlement.
Yeah.
Somewhere near there. They have other names for that, but I'm not convinced.
Apparently, but wasn't it like the size of Texas? Or it sounds like it's like a small area, like a ghetto or something. But I think as many square miles as Texas, the state of Texas.
Yeah, it was quite large.
So like, and it wasn't like this wasn't the Warsaw Ghetto or something.
No.
Nor was it Gaza.
Right. There was plenty of resources there.
Yes.
It was well situated geopolitically. And,
mm-hmm.
But Jews couldn't manage on their own. Yeah, there's that theory that the Jews are going to make Ukraine a second Israel, or maybe a refuge as Israel collapses and is destroyed. But I think it's broader than that. I think Ukraine will be the model Great Reset nation upon which all the rest will be based. And certainly there'll be Jewish power there, as there is now.
Isn't the home of the world's largest synagogue?
Yeah, so I've heard.
Yeah.
Not just Zelensky, of course, but the oligarchs in Ukraine and in Russia are still largely Jewish. Chabad Lubavitch, you were talking about Chabad on your last show.
Mm-hmm.
Major power in Russia. You know, Putin displaced the old Russian oligarchs and appears to have installed the new ones. Chabad.
So yeah, it's a strange, like Orthodox ascetic community that appears to be very powerful, which
and connected. Totally connected to every other kind of power in the world, including Putin. There's evidence for that. And certainly the United States, not just Crown Heights. The other war going on is the what I call the Hamas IDF war.
Mm-hmm.
That is nothing like the Pale of Settlement scale. It's not the size of Ukraine, but it is strategically located on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, nearby to the Suez Canal, and plans for the Ben Gurion Canal to the north and slightly east. There's talk of building an alternative to the Suez Canal. And Gaza is inconvenient for that project.
Interest in that area, I think it began in the early to mid 19th century, which coincided with sort of the Rothschild takeover of the Bank of England and the British Empire. But there's always been an interest in, particularly when oil was discovered and also other natural resources that people, you know, that powers find valuable.
Mm-hmm. George Washington Armstrong writes in his book, Zionist Wall Street, that the minerals of the Dead Sea region were worth trillions at the time. And that was the real objective of the Rothschilds, certainly oil as well. But it's more than that. The end goal of the Polarities Plan after the multipolar phase that's coming next is the Jew world order, one world government, and it's to be centered in Israel, in particular Jerusalem. As you know from the Mackinder map, the Mackinder Doctrine, which places that very region at the center of the three petals, Europe, Asia, Africa, with the United States and Australia on the what do they call it, the periphery, the fringe.
Mm-hmm.
So the Mackinder map really shows us the endpoint of the polarities plan. So it's far more than just access to oil and minerals.
Well, it wouldn't be a switch on the Mackinder doctrine is you know, Eurasia is the pivot of world control, world history. And so you, whoever controls Eurasia controls the world. And at least how I understood it was the Anglo, the sea power of Great Britain, Anglo-American, then the Anglo-American Zio Empire would work to destabilize, prevent the Eurasian landmass from coalescing, becoming a trading block or some sort of condominium, keeping it destabilized, so thus empower the sea power to control economic, global economic affairs, and therefore global power. And you're saying that they're transitioning to sort of supporting the, I guess, the development of a cohesive economic trading block on the Eurasian landmass, and also in the process, taking it over or hijacking it, and then leaving the United States, America, and the peripheral powers, you know, after they've been sucked, you know, bled white, just to, you know, collapse. Is that a fair characterization of what you're saying the plan is?
Yes, exactly. That is a shift from the, you know, the British balance of power approach. And the one of the reasons for World War One was a control of the Dardanelles, the shipping lane below the Black Sea. And now we're talking about a new Suez Canal.
Is this so it's a new great game?
Well, I'd say it's a further development on the great game.
Okay.
The devil's chessboard.
Haven't we gotten past that with liberal democracy and human rights and the United Nations?
No, that's all part of it.
Haven't we grown up? I watched Star Trek. No.
We're all living harmoniously together.
Yes, but why maintaining our ethnic distinctions and accents? So.
The New Silk Roads, the Belt and Roads Initiative, mm-hmm. is that condominium. It's that infrastructure development plan from China through the Middle East and connecting to Europe.
Now, some would say the certain recent events, particularly the fomented war in Ukraine, the Russian-Ukraine war, where you can look at in the past, since 2014, obviously, but even before that, is United States sort of, well, one thing was the expansion of NATO after the end of the Cold War eastward to Russia's, you know, doorstep. Even going so far as Ukraine, it was funny, even though that never was really in the plan, at least it was released. It was there to get Ukraine to talk about it, but never really accept it. But the idea was the reason why there's a war in Ukraine was to disrupt Germany's trade with Russia and maintain the NATO policy of keeping Russia out and Germany down. And so that would appeared to say that what the Western powers are trying to do is trying to maintain the Mackinder doctrine of keeping Eurasia from being from developing this condominium, if you will, this global trading block. And the war itself represents that there's resistance to. But you're saying all this, actually, it's sort of 4D chess. It's there to actually to accelerate de-dollarization, which it has done. So that's one mm-hmm. mark in your column there. It has accelerated de-dollarization. U.S. is doing itself with you know, they're going crazy with the sanctions. The sanctions office is controlled by Jews, by the way, at the Treasury Department. The Treasury Department is controlled by Jews. So that's a key node or choke point that they control. And so that this idea, you know, United States out there, you know, just fomenting these wars, whether it's like with the Houthis and Israel, supporting Israel, giving them a blank check and promoting a war in Ukraine, it would appear that there's a, while they talk about containing Russia and defending Israel, they're creating a situation of constant crises, which leads to the economic crisis, which will lead to the development of these BRIC countries.
Yes, exactly. Okay. The two best clues are the sanctions on Russia and the Nord Stream sabotage. The sanctions on Russia did not backfire. They were intended to shift power, and that's what they've done extraordinarily effectively. right? Russia is now motivated to develop currency exchange with China and really all the BRICS nations, and drop the US dollar. And therefore the US dollar is in decline. It's in less trust.
So how did China turn from a Maoist madhouse into the factory of the world? How did that happen?
Well, Mao died in 78. His wife took over with the Gang of Four.
Mm-hmm.
Then Deng Mingdao took over from them. He purged the government of communists. And
but the factories just spat out of the ground like mushrooms?
Well, I'm getting to that. Henry Kissinger.
Okay, yes. I'm sorry. I'm trying to prod you. Go ahead.
I know. It takes a few steps to get there. But yeah. Kissinger just died, so we wrote about him. He arranged the transfer of manufacturing from the United States to China.
How did he do that?
How did he do that?
How does this happen? Because you have all these factories in the United States. You have this strong middle class, working class, and you know, the factories that are some democracy. How does this deindustrialization occur? Why does it occur? I mean,
Kissinger was a advanced diplomat, right? Did they say he made 100 visits to China in his career?
Yeah, he had a lot of frequent flyer miles, yes.
His last flight was to visit Xi Jinping.
Who flies to China at age 100?
Before he died, yeah.
<It's> like,
right.
How much adrenochrome do you need to do that? Jeez.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if we needed it. It might have been theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
Just to confer, you know, his authority. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Kissinger was a big part of this power shift, which takes I'm looking at 15 years during one of these dispensations. Let's say during the power of the British Empire, the dismantling begins prior to the end, and it takes 15, 20 years. Kissinger was working longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes multiple blows, right? Multiple damage to the existing power to shift to the new power. The other example is the Nord Stream sabotage. Now, we get thinking about that, Tim, and just with our rational mind, that's Russia's infrastructure. Russia paid for that. Russia built that. But are we supposed to believe it didn't defend it or protect it? There was no security. And then after it was destroyed by whoever, whether it was Ukrainian fishermen or U.S. naval divers, it's fog of war there. But why didn't Russia just rebuild it? You don't hear anything about rebuilding the Nord Stream pipeline. So I say Russia is participating in the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline. And that's more difficult to see how that would favor a shift of power to Russia from the U.S., right? Because the U.S. is now supplying gas to Europe, mm-hmm. but at much higher prices. And the Europeans resent it, particularly the Germans.
Yes, they're having so many protests because of high energy prices. Someone is saying they may topple the government there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a Alternative for Germany party on the rise. But I thought the whole Nord Stream thing was suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to fit it into the polarities plan, but I think it fits. De-dollarization. This is being arranged from within the U.S. and from without. Right, Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury, former chairperson of the Federal Reserve. When asked, she said, yes, we can afford another war. Remember that interview?
Yes.
Which was, of course, a war for Israel.
It's within our budget. Budget? We don't need no stinking budgets. you just print the money.
Go deeper into debt.
Yes. That's the whole point of a dollarized global economy, right? Endless debt. That's
inflation. And
that's interesting because the talk about de-dollarization. what benefits has a dollarized global economy bestowed upon the United States?
Well, I was listening to an interview with Scott Ritter. He's in the same camp as Colonel McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
He said the Bretton Woods system, right, that was arranged after World War II, was a great benefit to the United States. It was an easy system for U.S. hegemony in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, how stupid were we to end that system? We had U.S. dollar hegemony. He said, what we've done now is make the dollar a suicide pill. I'm a sovereign nation. I want to do something, but I can't now because a dollar I used touched the banking system. Now the U.S. government can come in and tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
The arrogance of the Congress to say, if you touch a dollar, we own you. And then we say we want everyone to have their reserves in dollars. We put them in banks because of ease of commerce. And then we seize them. Then people say, I know it's inconvenient to be trading in rupees, but ain't nobody going to be seizing my money. And here's his key phrase. America has basically navigated itself out of a winning position. We were controlling the world because we had a system that enabled us to control the world with very little effort. And we've thrown that away with these sanctions, this arrogance. Then he says, BRICS had to grow up quick. Russia is taking over BRICS on January 24th. He said this in December. Today is January 24th.
Mm-hmm.
They are off to the races now. Good job, America. And I say, no, good job, world controllers. There you see, he pretty much described the deliberate de-dollarization, disempowerment of America from within. We did this to ourselves. And he's saying they were stupid and arrogant, and I'm saying they were strategic.
Okay, so yeah, so it's not stupidity, hubris, it's a plan. Now some would say it's chutzpah. The quality of American leadership has suffered. Our president's senile. Well, if that, I don't know if that matters. Because presidents don't really make decisions. So
right.
Theoretically, you can have a Max Headroom presidency or a weekend at Bernie's presidency, and it really doesn't make a difference.
Right.
So the dollarized economy post Bretton Woods the petrodollar system was good for the American empire, but was it good for Americans? I mean, was it good for their character, their society, their culture? What did fiat dollar do to American culture? What did it facilitate?
Well, I'm told the golden age of U.S. economics and the rise of the middle class occurred immediately starting in the post-war affluence and began to end, I'll say, with Reaganomics in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish organized crime installed Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
I wrote about that in my Jewish Control of U.S. Presidents, number two.
They also installed Pat Brown as governor and Reagan as governor, so they had both sides covered.
Right. Right.
it's an interesting story.
They pretty much installed Wilson.
Yes, the oligarchs.
To answer your question, I feel
there's much ruin in a country, as Adam Smith said, meaning these things take time. A country as wealthy and as productive with as many resources, not just the mineral wealth, natural, but the capital stock, its people. The human stock, the capital stock, it takes time for that to be wrought out. The idea of the fiat dollar, it would facilitate an economy that was overly financialized, bureaucratized, credit-driven, consumer-driven, as opposed to production and industry, right? So that's what we have where we talk about the growth of an economy in the United States. It's always about consumer spending, whereas you go to China, it's about what's being produced. Well, you really can't consume unless you're producing, unless you have a dollar you can print ex nihilo and just run the debt up, right? With the fiat dollar. But what does it do to the American culture? I think you kind of alluded to it in your articles. It promoted things like feminism. It promoted things like immediate gratification, consumerism, Hollywood, and all the degeneracy. So, nothing's free in this world. You have to work for it. But if you think if you engender an economy where people think they don't really have to work for it, it's going to create a very fat, lazy, degenerate culture. And it has. That is not right for being replaced, which it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's a moral interpretation of it. I can talk about the structure of that. Obviously, when you create the fiat dollar or the petrodollar, it creates an unusual demand for the US dollar. So a demand abroad, that's going to lead to the very deindustrialization or the exporting of jobs manufactured abroad, where labor is cheap and money's cheap. And that's what Kissinger's deal did. And it started to happen, it really take effect in the 80s under Reaganomics. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, if we have to draw a line, that was the shift from WASP power to Jewish power. Of course, it was developing prior to that and after that. Yes, yeah, so these efforts to degrade an existing power and shift it to a new power occur on the cultural level, the financial level, economic level, military level. We can talk about the degrading of the U.S. military. You know, Ritter said, we are going to see the rapid devolution of the United States. The world is going to go through a very rapid transition. Russia is in charge of BRICS this year. We are going to be de-emphasized on the world stage. 2024 is going to be the year that America devolves. The world is going to realize that America just doesn't matter anymore. The year of America's redefinition on a global stage, this is going to be a very bad year for America. This is Ritter's prediction. He's one of these so-called ex-military guys, CIA analyst, and very much like Colonel McGregor. I think he's talking about the Polaris Plan, the shift from the unipolar U.S. world to the multipolar BRICS world.
Well, obviously, he wrote too soon because I'm looking at the headlines and Trump won New Hampshire by double digits, so it's okay.
No, that fits into the plan just fine. As you said earlier, whether you're demented or not, or just egomaniacal, the president really doesn't make the decisions. He's a front man.
Yeah.
One more recent news that does go against the Polaris plan at this time is the election of Javier Milei in Argentina, at least for now. Argentina signed on to the BRICS Plus world in August of 2023, as did five other nations, and that went into effect January 1st of this year. But before then, Milei was elected in Argentina. He took them out of the BRICS agreement and is now going full Jewish, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
He's rejoined the West, and you know, the US is relieved and delighted, and because Argentina was going to join the BRICS system, and let's see, China had $120 billion to invest in Argentinian infrastructure. And Milei took them out of that. There's a whole essay by Litoria on Substack about how Milei got the Jews in Argentina to support him and install him, just as they did Zelensky in Ukraine. It's an extraordinary thing to read. You know, this comprehensive plan to buy Jews in Argentina, big money Jews, big power Jews, to install Milei, who didn't have a chance in hell, excuse me for saying so, but he made a fool of himself prior to that, you know, on television, and he was ridiculed as a fool. But these Jews funded his campaign. They used their media corporations they owned in Argentina and played up Milei and installed him. It's just an extraordinary story. This Jewish power of money and media can put anyone into the White House or the equivalent in Argentina. So that was, I think that's local Jewish money interests changing the trajectory of the Polaris plan in Argentina. But it's not changed in Iran, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and was the other two. UAE. Oh, I don't recall. There were six nations that joined BRICS. Iran being remarkable, right? Iran is part of the Belt and Road Initiative. again, this whole conflict that appears to be between the U.S. and Israel versus Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas. It may be theater. It may be real. There's real people dying and infrastructures being destroyed, and there is a war going on. But above the level of the war itself and two sides, it's a factor in shifting power from U.S. unipolar to BRICS multipolar.
Mm-hmm.
I was examining some of the news out of Iran. On January 3rd, there was that alleged terrorist attack on the fourth anniversary memorial of Qassem Soleimani's funeral. I don't know if you caught any of that.
Yes. Yeah. No one took credit for it, did they?
Since then, I haven't followed it. What I looked at most closely at was the reporting real, or was it literally theater? Was it, propaganda manufacturing?
Mm-hmm.
I looked at some of the videos, the pictures, the photographs, and some of the written accounts. It looked completely fake. And it was so illogical and irrational, the way they described it happening. And some of the video shows people in the video are like making hand gestures to say like action and come this way. And the blood was extraordinarily red. It looked like movie prop. I examined this in two essays on my Substack. So, I mean, it's possible now that the Israeli intelligence is producing this propaganda out of Iran and out of Gaza. They're producing propaganda on both sides. And if so, that would be something for us to seriously think about.
Well, remember, what was her name, Rita Katz? Where she admitted to producing, fake terrorist attacks or, killings.
Yeah, her outlet was called the Truth for Syria, or so Syrian.
Yeah, so that, yeah, it's like 2012. I remember that. And of course, then, those fake, what was it? Was it the White Hats?
Yeah, the White Hats.
They were caught faking like bombings and people fake victims, and they get, it was released, like it was like action, and you start acting and they stop. It's almost right. Like those were released on purpose just to drive everyone, kind of to create sort of a sense of epistemological confusion about you can't trust what you're saying anywhere, and you can't trust mm-hmm. the news, and you hear these things. And yeah, that was about 10 years ago. People, 10, 12 years ago, that was a thing. You had the various shootings like Sandy Hook and these things, the accusations that, it was fake, or part of it was fake, and all that. And then we had the whole Alex Jones litigation and ridiculous lawsuits and these things. And now it's not considered cool to question those things anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But we do.
We do.
Sometimes I forget. I admired Gemma O'Doherty. When you interviewed her, she was the first and only person I heard question the validity of the migrant knife attack on the school children in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
And I kicked myself. I'm like, oh, I didn't question it. I usually do, but they catch me sometimes.
Yes. Now, the funny thing is there's any number of attacks and crimes that occur that they could make hay out of, right? But then this one incident is highlighted internationally. It's very suspect. Yes.
George Floyd is another example of that.
Yeah, George Floyd is another one where, throughout the country, there's always some thug or some low life resisting arrest and acting stupidly with the police, and all of a sudden this becomes an international issue, which was really bizarre.
So if the Israeli unit 8200 is spinning up a fake terrorist attack on Soleimani's funeral anniversary, giving Iran an excuse or a justification for announcing, now we really hate Israel and we're going to bomb them, and which they essentially said something, that's of course simplistic, but they, Iran came out officially suspecting Israel. There were news reports in the United States and Israel saying absolutely can't possibly be Israel. You know, the guilty denying it before they're even accused. That means Iran is participating in the theater of expanding the Hamas-IDF war into the wider region by presenting a false flag incident, you know, with Unit 8200 and Israel really leading that. Or it's possible Iran is not participating, and it's all Israeli propaganda.
Is this push towards BRICS? Is this does this signal that that the Jewish elite have decided to support BRICS and kind of attach onto it, like they attached onto the Dutch Empire, then the British Empire, then the American Empire?
Yes, exactly. That's my theory. And we have to look at how that's going to be done, because most of us are taught to think that the BRICS countries are resistant to Jewish power, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have predominant power over the West, but they're struggling to get any power in China. Russia, I don't know who would believe that anymore, but Brazil, India. But there are some signs that, for instance, BlackRock is investing and even changing banking laws in China to improve their influence in China. Whether China is just going to use the international Jewish banking power and keep them on a short leash, and which is, I feel, Hitler did with Hjalmar Schacht, or whether, the Jews have been so effective at seizing control of anywhere they wanted.
Yeah, but China's not a liberal society. They're good at exploiting liberal societies, right?
What is China?
I would say it's, at this point, it's similar to a national socialist model.
I was going to say that, but people jump all over me when I say that. I get denounced, and
it's not communist.
No. It hasn't been since Deng Mingdao. I would say it's National Socialist. Do you know the Iraq under Hussein with the Ba'ath Party was considered, you can look on the Wikipedia entry, it says the Ba'ath Party is nationalist and socialist.
Mm-hmm.
It was secular.
But it's not National Socialist.
So the Jews couldn't take it over, but they could destroy it. Now they can't destroy BRICS. So I'm convinced they have their ways of worming their power into that. And
well, they need like quicksilver capital and borderless countries, or at least borders that don't mean anything, and free flow of capital and labor. They can arbitrage humanity, and we've been instructed for the past 60 years of sort of libertarianism that the free flow of labor and capital is a good thing, but it isn't necessarily a good thing, especially if those who've gotten control of capital have malevolent intent. It's like free speech in the First Amendment, you know, and the free press. Well, all that sounds great, but what if evil people get control of the printing press?
Mm-hmm.
Then you got a problem, which no libertarian or, traditional American ways of thinking can address it. This is the problem. And you can say, you have your high ideals, but you're dealing in fantasy. We have to deal with in reality. Good example. And who's really in control? Even in our free society, if we live in a capitalist society, you would think, the richest man in the world would be the most powerful man in the world. Well, evidently, we all know he's not the richest man in the world, but just recently Elon Musk had to go to make a pilgrimage to Auschwitz because of some bad things people are saying on his platform X regarding the Israeli Hamas conflict, as if Auschwitz has anything to do with Israelis, genociding Palestinians. Well, actually it does in a way, but not in the way they like to say. I mean, that's a little off, it's kind of a digression there, but it's kind of like, going back to what is it? It's because liberal capitalist societies are, at least as we understand it, are very vulnerable to infiltration and manipulation, ultimately control. And the name of the free market, an ethnic group or cabal of billionaires can buy up the political process, buy up the media. They can control the narrative, and it's like public opinion doesn't matter because public opinion is manufactured, as Walter Lippmann admitted 100 years ago. There's no real public opinion; it's just manufactured. And as this is the process, of technology, whereas actually, as the country gets wealthier and more technology advanced, it becomes easier to manipulate. Because
yes, exactly.
Centralized cybernetics and all that. So
a liberal capitalist democracy is the entry point for a plutocracy. It's a and that's the Jewish money power. That's why they promote liberal capitalist democracy. What the remedy to that is a free market system carefully regulated by a benevolent government. And I believe that's what fascism and National Socialism was. It's mistaken to say they were a public-private partnership, right? A government-corporate unholy alliance. No, the benevolent government of a fascist nation is carefully regulating the free market to ensure it doesn't become a plutocracy. William Joyce, he operated in Britain as a National Socialist, but he was Irish. He said, "It is the function of government to ensure that the freedom of the few does not become the enslavement of the many." So our liberal capitalist democracy has been taken over by a Jewish oligarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do you keep billionaires from rigging the system once they're billionaires?
progressive income tax? serious regulation.
But billionaires don't have income, so.
Oh, well.
They don't even use money.
Nationalization of major industries, including the media. Although fascist nations didn't do that. They regulated private media and produced government media, public media.
Mm-hmm.
But the question really I have now to I think the greatest challenge to the validity of the Polarities Plan is whether the Jewish oligarchs can gain sufficient power in the BRICS world.
Well, here's the thing. You advocate public supervision or state supervision of a free market to make sure that whatever they're doing with the media or with industries, they're doing for the interest of the nation. First of all, you have to have an idea of what a nation is, or you have to have borders and a people. Mm-hmm. All that, we're told not supposed to, it doesn't really exist anymore. But they'll say, well, if you grant any group of people in the state that power is going to be abused because we don't know what Lord Acton said. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Now, all that sounds, I understand that concern, but you turn that around. Says, okay, so that's a threat. That's a problem with any concentration of political power organization, to potential for abuse. But the opposite of that, if you have no state, how do you control rapacious billionaires? And they have no answer. So they have the same problem as those advocates of authoritarian regimes. Those advocates of libertarian regimes have the same problem. So at the very least, admit you both have the same, you have the same problem as the authoritarians, and you don't have an answer for it outside,
Frank Herbert, the author of Dune, said power attracts the corruptible.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is firm, strong central government leadership of uncorrupted and uncorruptible people. And Christianity has been a force for resisting corruption. That's one reason it was targeted for destruction.
Yes, the idea of a church checking the monarch, and idea of it requires an integral confessional state where everyone shares the same values.
Yes, values things. Beyond the material.
Yes.
Right? Ideals and values and morals that are not carnal in some sense, that are not at the lowest level of materialism. So now we have materialism is essentially the new religion, mammon, right?
Yes.
And that's been arranged. That's been a ongoing campaign.
Now who would do such a thing?
Come on. Someone with a whose religion is itself materialistic. and elevates power and money as the highest values and ideals, and doesn't really have a kind of afterlife where there's rewards or punishments for the ethical behavior on earth. So who are we talking about? Talmudics.
Yeah, but that's another thing. A lot of people think, at least we've been told, that our Talmudic friends are Jewish and they believe in the same monotheistic God as Christians. And it's a bit more confused than that. It's more Pharisaic and Talmudic, and you know, it's not as if they believe in it. It's sort of rabbinical magic. It's the Talmud. The Talmud's different than say Mosaic Judaism, and so like I said, even genetically, most of the Jews, like the Khazarians, aren't even genetically related to those of the Old Testament. But you're right. There is a fundamental confusion about what modern Judaism or Talmudism really is. You know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's some confusion about what Christianity really is.
Well, yes, that's it. Would grant you that. Yes.
But
yes.
Do you know the first place Javier Milei went to visit when he left Argentina after he was elected?
I'm going to guess Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, right?
Close, close. It was New York, because that's the location of the grave of the Chabad rabbi Menachem Schneerson.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. His name popped up in the news a couple of weeks ago. Well, wasn't his limo that like ran over those black kids in Crown Heights, which sparked the riots, I think.
Really? When was that?
Was it the early 90s? Late 80s?
He was in it?
I think it was his limo. I might be wrong about it. There's some important rabbi. They don't stop. This is one of the things you hear these stories of why there's riots and there's tension with the blacks in Crown Heights. It's because the Jewish community there is they don't. Now you could argue they might have a reason for not stopping.
Right. Well,
what I'm saying is they don't obey traffic laws, so there was that accident and.
Well, they don't obey human laws. The rabbi's daily schedule is more important than the lives of any goyim.
Yes, and they didn't call for an ambulance. The person, because of that, the child died, and that it was complete no consideration for the pedestrian that was struck. Yeah,
no, they prefer it actually. Yeah, the Polarity's plan is less focused on depopulation, but that's part of it. That's part of it. I know our common colleague Joseph Atwell sees depopulation as a major effect of many things we see in the world today and historically, and that's certainly part of it. But in my understanding, that's less the end goal, or at least the sequential goal, than the shift of power between the different polarities.
So you see this anomaly in the mid-20th century fascism, like the rise of, say, National Socialist Germany and other fascist leaders in Europe. They were the anomaly. They were genuine opposition. They weren't part of the Polarity's plan?
That's right. I do see it that way. I know others like Sutton and Joseph Atwell fit the fascist era in Europe as part of the power shifts as part of these dispensations. No, I see them as opposition to that, these X factors that were not planned for. I would include Joseph Stalin in that.
That's interesting, because you're opposed to the Polarity's plan doesn't mean you're a nice guy.
Oh, right? No, by no means. Okay. I mean, Hitler happened to be one, but no, you don't have to be a nice guy. They might have been, like Stalin usurped the Jewish plan for control of the Soviet Union by Trotsky, Lev Bronstein. And that you can read about that in a little booklet called Red Symphony by Landowski. Have you read that?
Yes.
I've read it twice. That's very fascinating. And I think it gets some things wrong, but unquestionably, the plan was for Trotsky to rule the Soviet Union. He married the daughter of a wealthy Jewish financier, you know, some communist, I say. But we understand that those two things are joined together.
Mm-hmm.
global capitalism, global communism.
Yeah, for a like a, for a penniless revolutionary, he lived rather high off the hog his entire life, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I had another
he starved
exception.
Many, but he never went hungry, so.
Oh, no. I thought I had a third exception. There's Stalin and the fascists were oppositions to the to this world plan. Oh, there might be one other I can think of. Maybe a number of others. Gaddafi in Libya, Morales in Bolivia.
How about Franco in Spain?
Nah, that's mixed.
Mixed? Well, mixed, but that's something, though.
Yeah, I think we can include that.
I mean, he was navigating what was happening in Europe. Some people say, you know, because he didn't align with the Axis powers, but he was trying to do what was best for his country. I don't know. In hindsight, yeah. But what was he to do? I mean, geez, Spain. Right. It turned out a lot better for the Spaniards, because it would have been a lot worse if the Republic had won, the so-called Republic, right? Republican side. So,
yes, I mean, I wrote an essay about that. Did Franco betray Hitler? But Spain was badly destroyed by 3 years of civil war, and that was a proxy war. Not entirely. The front lines were a clash between communists and nationalists in Spain, but there was lots of support from beyond on both sides. You could say that was really the start of World War II, given the proxy involvement.
It was a testing an arena for, but it, of course, under Franco, Spain had high birth rates, pretty good economic growth, and it gets adopts a liberal constitution, and now it's disintegrating. In the late 70s.
What's happening to Spain right now?
Well, like anything, it's birth rates are below replacement level. Very few practice the Catholic faith anymore. That's a function, at least a symptom of, you know, the lower birth rates are a symptom of that. And they join NATO. I think in the 80s, in the 80s they joined NATO, and now it's like all European countries, it's disintegrating, because basically they're not reproducing, which is the ultimate test of any whatever economic or social system you have. If it produces negative birth rates, it's a failure, because your people no longer exist anymore.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how to. That's like kind of like the acid test, if you ask me. So
that's one of them. I would say that the four factors that we have to have a nation at all is a secure border, a stable demographic population, free and fair elections, and a functioning military. But when we look at the United States, we don't have any of those.
No.
All four of those are gone. We don't have a nation anymore. And in my theory, that was deliberately... Those all four of those factors are deliberately brought into being by the Jewish power elite, this international cabal, to degrade and decline the power of the U.S. and shift to the BRICS world. You could probably say the same about Spain, although you might include like a cult, let's say a moral and ethical system, which is expressed by the Christian faith. And if that's in decline as well, then you don't have a nation. We certainly don't have a white Western Christian nation. And what do they replace that morality with? And that's what we're looking at today. And overwhelmingly, Jews are replacing that. Marxist feminism, you know, abortion, right? Pornography, transsexualism. Really grotesque, overtly evil things. But, you know, being presented as progressive and positive things. But it's a kind of twisted mind control game to in any way to present such things as positive.
Yeah.
It's astonishing.
And it presents actually more restrictions on speech and expression than otherwise would be the case in a traditional society, because as you do away with, well, generally speaking, if people are told not to develop or have internal self-control, you're going to have, if you have internal anarchy in yourself, you're going to have political anarchy, and you're going to have to make up for it in in authoritarian, you know, measures, a police state, if you will.
Right.
You know, and that's effective. That's what you have, like in cities like New York for decades. The only way they kept crime under control is they had a de facto police state. That's what Stop and Frisk was about, and that's, you know, these things. Because if you're going to create a Tower of Babel, you're not going to have a homogeneous society, high trust society. You have to have police maintain control.
Right.
And the moment that's relaxed, what do you get? You get the rioting and the looting in San Francisco and New York. The moment the police are withdrawn, which they've been withdrawn purposely to create that very effect of anarchy in
and
the
yet
cities.
the so-called criminal justice system is just promoting anarcho tyranny.
Yes, yeah,
There.
that's what prisoner reform is about, right? Criminal justice reform is just to open up. Open up
That's a
the
communist
jails.
strategy.
Yes,
that's totally communist. That was done in the Soviet Union.
It's bio-Leninism, I think. Where the elite use the low to smash the middle,
create chaos throughout the society, not just by lowering the moral standards and the cohesion of communities, but operating the justice system to incentivize crime.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's what the Soros prosecutors are all about, and
yes, exactly. Yeah. While we still have time, I want to mention, I sent you the archive link for this booklet, "The Jews and the British Empire" by L. Fry.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
1936. Oh, did you look it over?
Yeah, it's only about 6 pages. Quick, the monograph.
I was surprised. Yeah. It's very dense. It was published by the Sons of Liberty Press,
mm-hmm.
1936. I don't remember how I came upon this, but it pushed my polarities plan further back than the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
This person was, her real name was Louise Shishmaref. She married a Russian military man.
Is he a white Russian?
Something like that. But she was an American anti-Semite, pro-fascist author known for her book, Waters Flowing Eastward. A book which asserts that Jews were to blame for both capitalism and Bolshevism, and that it was primarily certain Jews who started World War I. She does attribute some of that to Freemasons. But she says the ultimate aim of these particular Jews was world domination. These conclusions were based in part on her study of the Protocols of Zion. But in this booklet, it's really 6 pages.
Yeah.
It's called Jews and the British Empire. She explains how the British were conducting trade and commerce and, based on trust and fair play and honest dealings. And this made them susceptible or vulnerable to the Jews and the wily foreign traders. She said, it also stands at the base of the further exploitations practiced upon them by Jews for the realization of their messianic ideal of world domination. The rise of the British Empire is clearly linked to this Jewish messianic ideal, bearing today the name of Zionism, which aims at universal economic and financial control to be followed by political power in every nation. 1936. But she goes back... Holland supplants Spain. Spanish and Portuguese sailors and soldiers fought for the possession of lands where Jews later implanted their trade. This is how the Jews were sort of latching on to these earlier polarities, the Spanish and Portuguese Empire, which reminds me, I want to mention something. One of these strange synchronicities I'd learned. When last we talked, Tim, you mentioned this creepy novel, Philip Drew Administrator.
Oh, yeah.
And that reminded me of
Colonel Mendel House, right?
Mendel House, yes. Yeah. That reminded me of the creepy novel by Benjamin Disraeli, the first and maybe only Jewish prime minister of Great Britain, called Coningsby.
Yeah.
And I was trying to remember the name of the character in that novel that represented Rothschild. And the name was Sidonia.
Mm-hmm.
Which seemed like a strange name because that sounds more like a place. But when I was researching the Polarities plan to see about the shift from the Spanish Empire to the British Empire, which this book here by Shishmaref says actually goes through the Netherlands, the Dutch Empire, I found out that the admiral that led the Spanish Armada that lost to the British fleet in 1588 and was a key factor in the shift was named Sidonia. So why would Disraeli name his Rothschild character Sidonia if that was the commander of the Spanish Armada that lost? Well, maybe because the loss of the Spanish Armada by this character, the admiral, the real historical person, Sidonia, was a great benefit to the Rothschilds.
So they didn't kick them all out in 1492, did you say?
Well, no, they did. And L. Fry, Shishmaref, says they went to the Netherlands.
Yes.
They started the Dutch East India Company and built up their power on the backs of the Dutch Empire.
Mm-hmm. Went into publishing and banking, for what I understand, yes.
What else? Yes.
And I think international commerce. Was not the first European central bank that the Bank of England was based on?
Which one now, in the Netherlands?
The Netherlands, yeah. And then
did she say so in that book?
No, I don't think so, but I think I just recall from memory is I think that was the first European central bank, which the Bank of England would be based on. And I think that was established in 1694. Was it Patterson who convinced the king to do that?
1694.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
The Netherlands, having an efficient navy, were elected to replace the Portuguese and Spanish. Mm-hmm. Jewish trade went on unhampered under the new nominal owners, but it was diverted to Amsterdam and Antwerp. These are quotes from this booklet. Jews and British Empire. So I'm saying the same thing's happening today.
Yeah, and they bankrolled Cromwell too, who killed the Stuart King, Charles I, whose wife was Catholic. So this is at that time when the Protestant, the English Reformation, the Protestant control, the Whig ascendancy hadn't yet occurred yet, and that wasn't a decided thing yet. In fact, it wasn't ultimately settled into what Bondi puts Charles early 18th century, but it wasn't quite secure. That's why you had the English Civil War, and a century later,
yes, 1640s. The Jews in the Dutch Empire were threatened by the independent British trade, if allowed to develop unchecked, might shatter Jewish monopoly. So you had the Dutch East India Company, and then you had the British East India Company. So the Jews said, well, we have to get into England. Mm-hmm. And Cromwell was presented with a petition for Jewish return to England in 1655 by Manasseh ben Israel. And thereafter, the Jews re-entered England behind Cromwell.
Yeah, they'd be kicked out, what, in the 13th century? Yeah, 13th century.
1205.
Yeah, right? Edward Longshanks. Yeah.
Edward the First.
Yeah.
1200 something.
Yeah.
Yes. That was the first time. Maybe it wasn't the first time. They been kicked out of England multiple times. Cromwell brought him back in. He was not of the aristocracy, right? He was a commoner, from what I understand.
Yeah, well, he was a member of the House of, he was a Parliament, House of Commons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This next section says William of Orange. In the secret councils of the elders of Zion of those days, Britain was elected to replace the Netherlands. This is speaking exactly what I needed to find.
Mm-hmm.
How Jews just arrange the shifts of power from one empire to the other, and they ride the shift. They go from one to the other. And just the big question I have now is, how are they doing it into the BRICS world? This is how they did it in these earlier empires, right? Spain and Portugal to the Netherlands to Britain. And then that's where my timeline starts, Britain unipolar world for however many years.
Well, in England, I mean, the Great Britain, the British Empire, in the 19th century, you had, of course, the Rothschilds who take over the Bank of England in the early 19th century. Some say this was the coup, the financial coup after Waterloo. But then at that point, they're able to sort of insinuate or buy themselves into the British aristocracy. And you have also the repeal of some of the restrictions. Jewish emancipation that occurred all throughout Europe in the 19th century opened up the gates to Jewish penetration of these increasingly liberal societies in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars and the French Revolution, Enlightenment ideas and all these things. So they're able to take advantage of this. And of course, you also had the phenomenon in England where you had a cash poor but land wealthy aristocracy. This is sort of the spoils of the dating back centuries, good dating back to the Protestant English Reformation when church property was seized. Well, in the 19th century, they increasingly wanted to build these estates. They went into debt to the Jewish creditors, and that was financial leverage for the Jews to get control of the British establishment. And the great example of that is the Churchill family. And yes, they would make pretty much call in their favors in the 1930s with the when Churchill started to campaign against Germany in the
1936. Robert Whately Cohen was the president of British Royal Shell, the oil company, which was a holding of the Rothschilds. And he approached Churchill. Well, Churchill was bankrupt from losses in the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And this Jewish president of the Rothschild Oil Company gave Churchill £50,000 and like a cottage on an estate. And they hired him to start writing.
Mm-hmm.
He was a journalist. And yes, exactly. That was a superb summary of that whole period, Tim.
Well, that's just a good example of what happens when you worship mammon. You will worship those who have control of the money, as opposed to like do what's right for your country. You will literally sell out your nation's patrimony. You can, and with control of finance, the Jews or wealthy billionaires, most of them are Jews, can literally leverage buyout of a country's patrimony. They can buy up historical sites. They can renovate Monticello and turn it into an anti-white display and make it do. They can order. They can buy up museums and these things, and you lose your cultural patrimony, your nation's patrimony. All because of money.
They have to seek out people who are susceptible to the money corruption.
And those are academics. Those are scientists.
Right.
They're not immune from that temptation. They want to eat and have houses and have status, and they're very easily bought out. Especially if they're not alerted to it. Remember, they're also trained to have an allergic reaction, any suspicion of Jewish power in this country. Any suspicion, the slightest. Right.
Any orientation to a morality above money and power.
Yeah.
Celebrities and politicians, in a sense, politicians are celebrities. And they're totally susceptible to these power appeals, their ego. But they don't really have the power, right? So those who know that these people are susceptible seek out money domination.
Yes.
So they can use them. It's almost as if they're not really interested in the money itself. They're just interested in the way it can exercise power over others that they place into positions of not really power, but they're operatives, right? They're front men.
Yeah, and after a while, what gets established is a sort of a negative vetting system where the worst do get on top. You get this cacistocracy. But it's not just evil people ruling over you. These political managers are serving patrons. No. And if you can just follow the money. I think of, the top 10 donors to the Democratic Party are Jews, and the top 8 donors to the Republican Party are Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The money dominates. Look at BlackRock's stock ownership in every major corporation, NGO. You only need so much that if you sell it off, the stock price tanks.
Yes.
And that's your threat.
Well, look how Harvard buckled. They have a $45 billion endowment. You know, and they're backing down to $100 million donation threats. Well, what it is their endowment can be, you can make war on their endowment through the financial power. So I think they're much. Bill Ackman wasn't the only threat they got, you know, to get rid of Claudine Gay, because she gave lip service to the First Amendment and didn't show proper enthusiasm for Zionism. But now it's out in the open. I mean, it's like, who can deny it now? It could be the silver lining to all this is the more arrogant they get, the more revealed they are, and which increases the opportunity, at least the chances for like some sort of opposition to it, at least recognition of it.
This is our hope. As things get worse, things have the potential to get better. I mean, Jewish students were facing a second Holocaust on these campuses, so they had to. And you had to do something, these presidents weren't doing nearly enough and all this hysteria. I really would like to read this quote from Shishmaref. L. Fry, this is, you were speaking to this just a moment ago under the section Traders' Profits. Jewish coffers got fuller and fuller, full to overflowing. The Bank of England is their counting house. England has laid all her possessions at the feet of Nathan Rothschild. Henceforth, Britain will do the bidding of her real masters. Jewish Prime Minister Disraeli, flunky of the powerful Rothschild financiers. A Zionist world empire is on the high road to realization. Yeah, this is just earlier developments, earlier sequences of the Polarities Plan. When people ask me, you'll hear people say, well, how can Jews control whole empires and even like shift the power from one to the other when there's so few of them? The last Jewish census they did themselves showed Jews were 0.2% of the world's population, 15.3 million. How can they do this? Well, we've been talking about it, right? This financial control.
Yeah, doesn't money
And you
make the
don't
world
even have
go
to.
round?
Money makes the world go round,
Yeah.
yes.
So there you go.
No. Love really makes the world go round, but money is the substitute. Love of money is the root of all evil. That's from your book. Love of power or lust for power.
Yes, that's it's libido dominandi, yeah.
What really is the motivation of this Jewish power elite, as I call it, maybe the Zionist banksters is a good term, operating the global financial system as an organized crime racket? And Zionists being not just a homeland for the long-suffering, long-wandering Jewish people, but as the epicenter for the future world power, which is the end goal of the Polarities Plan. That's what makes Zionism or the Zionist nation so much more than just this homeland idea. And I think it was from the beginning. They were positioning Israel as an epicenter of Jewish power in the world, and now sequentially moving that power through these vectors, these channels, until it all finally ends up in Israel and in particular in Jerusalem. Now, this plan requires I think it's probably a religious dispensation that all the area within the borders of Israel, whatever they are, be purged of non-Jews. Any goyim has to be gone. And that's the war in Gaza and the West Bank. That's one of their dispensations that has to be put into place. I don't know what
And
more to
they
say
appear
about
to be
that.
carrying, well, they appear to be carrying it out, at least in Gaza. And the October 7th attack provided the pretext for it.
Right.
And now
Which
they can carry it out. You know, they kill 50,000. They're chase the other, the remaining, you know, 2 million out. And as if they've been saying, well, let's, first Egypt. No, we'll send them to Europe, United States. Why not? That's their attitude. They actually said that. There's a plan for that. You know, Israel and the United States both are, I think, are signatory nations to the Geneva Convention against, or at least the UN Convention against genocide. And it's meeting all the definitions of genocide, but they're just saying they're not doing it. So they just deny it as they do it. And
South Africa presented,
yes.
South Africa brought a legal case for intent to genocide at the International Criminal Court. Very powerful. I saw this speech by the white woman from South Africa, and a black man from South Africa was a lawyer, also presented the case at the International Criminal Court. It was very powerful.
Well, at the same time, multiple Israeli officials and military officials claiming the very thing, boasting of doing it. It's hard to defend yourself that on record.
Well, that's what the case presents.
Yes.
That's one thing it presents.
You have the statements and the actions. No.
These people said so themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They put it all together in this legal case. It's a very powerful thing. I was just watching Judge Napolitano interview. What's that Jewish guy's name? A lawyer. Jeffrey Sachs.
Oh, The Economist.
They were talking about this legal case at the International Criminal Court from South Africa. And Sachs said, you know, Napolitano asked him, how are they going to get around this? And Sachs said, oh, they're just going to deny it. They're just going to say it's a blood libel. They're just blaming Jews for being mean with no good rationale. But that's what they've already done.
Well, you can't arrange international boycott because that's anti-Semitic. You can't protest to boycott Israel because in 36 states, United States, you'll lose your job or get cut off from, several universities won't, you're not allowed to do that in. And look at Governor DeSantis, the first, did he fly to Israel to sign that law or something?
Isn't that against U.S. law to sign a law in another nation?
I know.
It should be.
These are favors they're doing for us when they do things like that. That's
the utterly outrageous behavior of the IDF in Gaza is being said quite often in many different places by many different people as possibly the end of Israel. The international sentiment is turning against Israel. So the United States Association and, you know, doubling down on our support for Israel, at least at the power level, not amongst the population, is one way that the reputation and the power of the United States is being degraded. So that fits the polarities plan. That's just one other way that the United States is in decline by remaining supportive of Israel.
Even though the U.S. foreign policy is being run and being implemented by Jews.
Yes. Yeah. How about that?
Being decided.
That's a very good point. That means Jews have to be riding the shift.
And we do know that because of what happened at Harvard and all these billionaires getting upset about people protesting Israel, that they sowed Israel with Jews, and there's no distinction. So therefore, whenever you have Jews in government or Jews in a position of culture, economic power, they are primarily Israeli, and they identify with a foreign nation whose interests are probably not in line with our own.
Right. So the decline of U.S. reputation because of clinging to Israel at this time means that, the Jews that control the U.S. are pushing that, are maintaining that foreign policy of support for Israel. But Israel is not going to suffer from that decline in U.S. reputation because it's existing now at the eye of the storm where it's calm. There's a storm going on around it, but it's going to maintain its integrity. There won't be any military. There'll be small terrorist actions in Israel. There'll probably be false flags that Israel will arrange for itself just to maintain some victim status while the destruction and the conflict goes on around it. And it's continuing its shift to the BRICS power, which would include Russia. And even behind the scenes, you know, overtly, there's conflict between Israel and Iran. But at the level of the Polarities Plan, there is not. There's cooperation. And these, what appear to be fake false flag events in Iran may be part of that, right? To incite the broader regional war, but in a way that Israel is not really damaged by it. Which I say that's just something we're going to have to watch. Mm-hmm. And I would say prepare ourselves to look for, because that's happened in the past. You know, this operation in Gaza right now is not outside of a pattern. We had Operation Protective Edge in 2014 and Operation Cast Lead in 2009. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there were others prior to that. The difference is the current operation is orders of magnitude larger. Mm-hmm. The deaths are 10 times bigger than Protective Edge and growing, probably 15 now.
Yeah, and it's so disproportionate to the raid that occurred in October. It was a 24-hour period, and that was it. And now they're using it as a pretext. And it's Israel is on record. One minute they, or one breath, they'll say that Hamas is illegitimate, doesn't represent the Palestinians, then they use an excuse to kill all the Palestinians. Well, which is it? Mm-hmm. You can't say they're all, you know, guilty and saying they're not representative, so they're contradicting themselves. It's like they say, we're not bombing hospitals, but we have a right to. Oh, we had to do it. Oh, which, human shields. They're using hospitals as military bases. I think they blew up a university recently, claiming it was being used by Hamas, even though it was controlled by Israeli for IDF. Then they demolished it. It looked like a controlled demolition. So the destroying the cultural sites, they're destroying all the hospitals, the buildings. 80% of the buildings have been destroyed. So obviously they're clearing it. And so they're going to create facts on the ground and say, they're all gone now. And so now this will be new Israeli territory.
Fait accompli.
Yes.
Yeah, I call this chutzpocracy. You've mentioned these. Another great chutzpocracy of Jews is advocating open borders for the West and tightly closed borders for Israel.
Yes. And who is in control of our immigration policy in the United States?
Yes. Mayorkas and
yes.
Hayes and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hayes is caught organizing I guess waves of immigrants from all over the world into the United States via Mexico. And how does that happen?
Right. You know. Jewish Family Services. Mm-hmm. Also in Europe, Paideia.
Yes, well, that's openly ragged about it. You know, she predicted that people would resent Jews, but just something that's going to have to be accepted because Europe's going to have to change. And like, I didn't, who voted for you? I mean, who are you?
Yeah.
But that's the attitude.
Oh, it's painful to watch that video, and it keeps coming up.
Yes.
It's very popular, if that's the word.
But like I said, you can cite these organizations. You can cite these, you know, these comments, the organizations that these people represent, the money they're getting, the fact that multiple governments throughout the EU, United States, have Jews involved in controlling border policy or immigration policy, and that are facilitating this, and they still say, well, you can't blame Jews for it because that's anti-Semitic. Because there's the Jews, which do exist as a people. They have organizations, they have an identity in organizations, then they're individual Jews. But that's true in any situation. It's like saying, so that's really not a relevant point. I was saying there are organizations that are Jewish that are spearheading this. And part of the reason why they're spearheading is their Jewish identity, their objective.
Yes. Which makes it hard to believe there's any individual Jews.
You know, if there are, then he's, you know, yeah, effectively they're yeah. Well, you know, the individual Jews that are against it don't have any power, so they're irrelevant. You know, it's
Yeah,
like,
they're self-hating Jews.
yes, I mean, it's
We
not
know
like he's, you
know
know,
some.
yeah, it's not like Ron Unz or, you know, has any political power. You know, and we make those distinctions when we can, but it doesn't address the wider political issue or the dilemma or the problem we're facing.
Man,
It's
Ron
actually,
Unz is an interesting case. He may have media power, mind power. Very strange. What's I'm not clear on Unz review, and I submit some things Unz review. It's got a huge reach. It's probably the largest independent media site on the internet. It's very active with the commentary, and many authors are submitting there. And I don't know what to make of it. He's got that American Pravda series. He's kind of a Jewish oligarch himself, with his financial services and his huge data storage platforms, and he's running this UNS review, and he's writing about, you know, Holocaust denial and denouncing the ADL and the oddities of the Jewish religion is one of his
Yes,
essays.
the Black Legend of Adolf Hitler.
I don't know what to make of Ron. Is he a honey trap, or is that?
His analysis is pretty dispassionate, but he points out all these various points that I've come across in various people's books. Like some of the books he recommends, I happen to read over the course of 20 years. Like, oh, he's read the same books and he's highlighted them.
Very good stuff.
Yes,
And he
so
puts it in audio form so you can listen to it.
listen to it. Yes, and all the
Very
links. Yeah,
interesting.
I mean, his
Yeah,
article in California was excellent about the mob and Ronald Reagan and you know, Judge Basilin and how the Jews took over California. It's stolen property and nepotism, and it's like,
Yeah, he
you
is
know,
on top of every
yes.
Jewish taboo issue that you can't write about. He even wrote about why the ADL didn't really come after him after he wrote Holocaust Denial and other things, you know. Well, they just don't want to bring attention to me. You know, if they try to, you know, counter-propagandize me, smear me, and that'll just bring more attention to my work. So they're taking the obscure and avoid strategy. But I don't know if that I'm not sure I trust Ron Unz.
Well, you don't have to. So
I kind of do it
you don't have to enjoy his website.
if I'm submitting there. I do. I
Well,
should.
it's, I mean, the problem is you can be so skeptical and suspicious, you don't go anywhere.
Yeah, well, exactly.
That's the nature of the world we live in. Sorry.
Some of my Substack colleagues are encourage me to submit it UNS review because you get a greater reach, you have a larger audience, which is entirely true.
So.
I want to mention something here before we
Sure.
close about Ukraine. Someone named Stavrula Pabst is writing now on Unlimited Hangout, Whitney Webb's outlet. She wrote this essay, "Ukraine's Future Lies in the Great Reset." Ukraine has a minister of digital transformation named Mykhailo Fedorov. Now, did you know that Ukraine had a minister of digital transformation? Does the United States have a minister of digital transformation
Probably
or a
not uniform.
secretary?
You're probably not singular, but there's probably someone who does something like that, whatever that position is. I would have to think Ukrainian government has greater priorities at this point, but that's fine. It's interesting.
Isn't it Eric? Might be Eric Schmidt. He's been appointed to the United States Commission on AI or something.
Google, or you could call Google that or something, right?
She says,
In typical American fashion, it'll be, you know, the private, it'll be privatized, you know. Typical American fashion, our slavery will be privatized.
It's Silicon Valley generally.
Yeah.
But I think probably every nation now has a minister of digital transformation equivalent. What this guy, Mykhailo Fedorov, said was Ukraine is to be the freest and most convenient country in the next 10 years.
Whatever that means,
The
write that.
freest and most convenient.
Most
Those
convenient.
two things that, well, it's going to be totally digitized. You can get a passport just by using the They already have the Dia app, the everything app. And there's one app on the phone that can do everything you need to do in Ukraine. You can open a new business. You can get a passport. You can get your government benefits. You can pay your utility bills. You can manage your bank account.
And convenience always redounds in greater freedom, right?
Freedom and convenience. Yes. Actually, those two things are antithetical. No.
When you go to a convenience store, everything's like twice as expensive, right? There's a cost for this, right?
And it's cancerous.
Yeah. Yes. Who is it convenient for? Well, those who gather data, right? The data billionaires, the data. That's the new gold, right? The new oil is data.
Convenience is like temptation by the devil.
Mm-hmm.
It sucks us in. Convenience, but it's convenient for the oligarchs. This is how they will control the panopticon in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And that's the model for the rest of the world. That's really what looks to be the case. BlackRock is talking about, and Zelensky is working with BlackRock to reinvest in Ukraine, the rebuilding. It's really ghoulish. I mean, it's really.
Well, yeah, ghoulish it is, but then again, they're ghouls. So we shouldn't be too surprised by that, unfortunately. There are some technical difficulties. It appears that I lost audio connection, so the interview was abruptly ended. We were nearing the end anyway, so I'll just so thank Carl for coming back on the show. Carl is the author of COVID Culprits. He's also a frequent contributor to the Barnes Review and is the proprietor of Taboo Truth, his Substack page.
For this day I shall die, so let the sun never set. Victoria, 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 Victoria.
One more time, baby.
Victoria, Victoria.
Australia, choose to come on,
yeah.
Singapore.